So over the past 3 years, I have been facilitating a community-based repatriation project with, by, and for Tsimshian peoples, but have been working primarily with people from Lhokholams, which is my home village.
And what exactly does that entail?
Well, repatriation, you know, as a word, means to return something or someone to their place of origin. And so most repatriation cases in the context of indigenous peoples are known through the experience of reclaiming human remains or ancestors that have been taken, looted, graves looted in the past, and these bones end up in different places around the world, particularly universities and places like that. And then you also know of other cases of what people would consider tangible heritage and reclaiming things like totem poles or masks, thinking about it from a Tsimshian perspective. But of course, there are other indigenous nations out there who have experienced the same thing and have reclaimed other items that are sacred to them too.
Right. When I think, I'm sorry to interrupt you. No. When I think repatriation, I do tend to think of those museum items that get brought back to a home territory, as you say, like the totem poles. But in this case, you're looking at songs.
Exactly. And that is quite a unique case. Most people don't understand how you can repatriate song, which is something that we think of as an intangible, something that you can't touch. But throughout research and different collectors in the past, and the way that Western property law works is that as soon as you press record on, like you're doing right now, you own the rights to the recording. It becomes a knowledge product. So the song gets transformed from an intangible thing, entity, to a tangible one because it now exists in a product form, a knowledge product, on tape, on videotape, on reels, as it was in the case of our case study with the songs.
So. Okay, maybe you can take us into the case study. Like, how did you first learn about this, and where has it gone from there?
Well, just a little background. I was born and raised in Vancouver. And since I was a teenager, my mother, my brother, and I have been a member of a Tsimshian dance group down there. It's called Lachain, which is appropriate. It's to reference, you know, this area here in Prince Rupert, because many of our members came from Prince Rupert into Vancouver. And this dance group has been a critical site of enculturation for us outside of our territories. The leader of the dance group, Christine, who George interviewed yesterday during our listening gathering, you know, I was going to school. I was at the University of Massachusetts at the time and doing my master's degree. And she said, you know, just real casually one day, you know, Robin, can you keep an eye out for our songs while you're out there doing your studies?
Wow.
And I was like, I was really a profound question for me, and I didn't really quite know how to grapple with it or understand what to do. I never intended to do repatriation in my research, and I didn't intend to work with songs. It just sort of fell in my lap. The nature of community-based research is to listen to community-identified needs, priorities, and values, and to respond to that in a positive way that is inclusive of all people, and so that it doesn't become me, the researcher, the all-knowing researcher who gets things done. Rather, it's really switching the emphasis on community capacity.
Yeah, maybe you can take me into that moment a little bit more. I mean, you're studying in Massachusetts on the other side of the continent.
Yeah.
Why on earth would there be Tsimshian songs all the way over there?
Yeah, exactly. Well, she just kind of understood that I would, you know, I did a lot of traveling, and she kind of thought, well, while you're out there, you know, can you keep an eye out? The reason why our cultural heritage is scattered across the landscape, sort of in the same ways that our children were when they were taken into residential schools, is because of this long sordid history with settler colonialism, right? And for Tsimshian from Lhokholams in particular, we experienced a form of hyper-dispossession in quite a short amount of time.
And what does that mean?
Meaning that the settler colonial project in Canada and the United States is based off of this premise of indigenous dispossession and elimination. Let us get rid of and clear the way of Native people so that we can settle these places and create these national polities like Canada and the United States. And in order to do that, you have to dispossess Indigenous peoples of the things that you want, like land,
right?
And like rights and like, you know, the list goes on.
And hence these songs are taken from a place and they're put into the ivory tower, never to be seen again.
Into an archive. Yeah. And of course, like, that's what I'm trained as an anthropologist now. I just completed my PhD. And what we learn, right, about the history of anthropology is that that's that salvage era of anthropology, where there was these racist ideas about Indigenous peoples that we would disappear, at least like literally or at least culturally. And so people of all types, amateur collectors, adventure travelers, missionaries, anthropologists, rushed into our territories, especially the more northern ones, to salvage as much as they could before we were thought to disappear. And of course we haven't. And and then they are, because I was talking about the Western laws, the way that those work, that they can, you know, claim these things as their property, and then it becomes alienable wealth, right? Like things that they have the choice of what to do with it. And many of those people sold these things or named the collection after themselves and donated them to universities.
I see.
And so they really promote this idea of them knowing about us in some form because they have these artifacts, or they've captured our voices in some way, either through, you know, just learning the language or recording people singing songs, for instance. And so in our case, in 1942, a woman by the name of Laura Bolton came to Prince Rupert and Lacholam's in June and recorded two Tsimshian men who were in their 80s at the time. And of course, 1942 is a critical time period. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, racial segregation still here in Prince Rupert, and Indigenous folks didn't have full rights. There was a World War going on. Research ethics were not yet instituted at a global level. You know, so it's, I'm talking about the conditions in which someone like Laura Bolton, an amateur collector, could come in, you know, say, hi, I really want to, you know, please sing for me. I'm going to record this. And then we have no idea if she said anything to them about, do you know that once I press record, I own this and I can do what I want with it.
Yeah.
And of course, what she did was 20 years later was sell her collection of music that she recorded around the world between 1930 and 1960. She sold that collection to Columbia University in New York City. So, you know, about a year or so after, Christine says, can you keep an eye out for our songs while you're out there doing your studies? A colleague of mine in my grad program approached me one day and says, hey, are you Tsimshian? I was impressed that she remembered, for one. And then I wondered why she wanted to know. And she proceeded to tell me that she was doing some research on her own. She was into cultural heritage stuff and was looking at a metadata notes in an archive at Columbia University. And she said, I noticed there was some songs there from, and it says Tsimshian people from Port Simpson and Prince Rupert. And immediately, you know, I get chills and I think, oh my God, like I haven't been actively seeking out, searching for the songs, but somehow they ended up finding me. And so that really pushed me into, you know, a sense of hyper accountability to that earlier request by Christine and really understanding the significance of it. I knew that she didn't want to reclaim them just for herself because she's a singer, a dancer, a leader, a composer. But I could see why she viewed them, these old songs, as potential sources of healing and reclamation for our peoples at the individual and collective level.
I have to ask you to back up for just a moment, because when I think about growing up, for instance, and this is from, of course, a different perspective, I think about the songs that were passed down to me, like British nursery rhymes particularly.
Okay,
you know, these are something that we would hear every day. Now I sing them to my own children.
Mm-hmm.
Was that not the same in Lacholam's with some of these songs?
What do you mean by that? Could you
clarify? I'm just wondering if the sharing was different, if these songs were lost because of the time, what was happening, and that only, it's only because of these recordings that they still exist.